This is a Collider.com audio interview.
Good morning, sir.
How are you?
We'll make the joke.
I'll be good.
You'll make the joke.
You are extraordinary.
You get a lot of that. Ding, ding.
You know, the later at night it gets, the more people grab and the harder it gets. Especially when people have been drinking.
Oh, yeah. It's like standing on the subway, isn't it?
That has not happened yet.
I got a story about that. I've talked about that. There's a friend of mine, Terry Rowley. He's in his... Well, he's a little older than me, which means he's getting older. But he's always had an eye for the ladies. And he said, I was on... He's a cockney, he's in London. And he said, I was on the tube, the other evening, on the underground. He got standing there, he started reading my paper. He said, and I looked around and goes, there's... He said, oh, I can't read. I think she's nice. And this woman, he said, oh, she's very nice. And she looked and she...
Oh, no.
he said he felt so humiliated. Yeah. He's got great sense of humor. He said, that was killed me.
Ryan said that you have no weak spots in your.
Who said that?
Ryan. He said that he couldn't spot your weak spot.
so what
is it?
My weak spot is laziness. I mean, no, it's. Oh, I got lots of spots, cookies, and croissants. No, my wife is always lecturing about it. I tend to put it all down as, and say, oh, it's just joke, all of it, acting. But people ask me this, how did you choose the part? How did you prepare for it? I said, well, I just learned the lines and showed up. She said, you shouldn't say that. But I don't know what else to say because that's all I know how to do. But my weak spot is that I don't like analysing, so I tend to be a bit lazy. I tend to think, I get bored very quickly, which means I must be boring. But the thing is that I've been through situations where films have been rewritten, and I was in a film once, not that long ago, I'm not going to mention names, but it was already a good script, but the director, a very nice guy, but he said, we want to discuss these scenes, let's get together and in a hotel somewhere up in Canada. You sit around this table in the conference room, and, you know, which is the most depressing place, and, you know, comfort inn or something. A pot of coffee in the room. And you've got to be, and said, let's go to page 64. Oh, God, oh, why are we rewriting? And I said to him, I said, why are we rewriting this? It's perfectly fine. Well, we just need to make it. And the film just went. And on this one, there's a little bit of that, but it wasn't. But it was for a good reason, because Ryan was concerned about the, and he's right, because he was concerned about the actual accuracy of what happens to the gun, the forensic element of it, the detective, what happens to the gun, how did they get it, what about the fingerprints, what about, I mean, is it going to stand up, is a lawyer going to pick this film apart, because all that was going on. So when Greg said, we've got to have the discussion with the lawyers, and now that's my weak point, because I should have paid attention. But what happened was, and I discovered that I said to Ryan when we came back to do the reshoot, that he and Greg and some of the writers got together and really put it together. And when we went to do the reshoot in January, I said, well, thanks, it's a really fine ending now. I tend to be a little bit, I suppose I want to go home. I just see, no, you don't bring from when they want to re. That's my weak spot. But I don't know. I think it's a weak spot, really. I should be much more. Yeah. But sometimes I think, oh, why bother?
Ryan said you were kind of a hero of his.
He's wonderful.
It was sort of hard for him when he first started working because he was watching you like you were in a movie. And he said, oh, I mean, I'm in this too. How do you make somebody, because you know you are considered like this, really an actor, how do you make somebody confident in themselves or not watch you?
I didn't know. I'm never aware of that when it's happening. But, well, he's interesting because the way the kind of formalistic thing of this film is, what I like about it is I'm a fan of this sort of movie, like Jagged Edge or Presumed Innocent, Sleepers, which I watched again yesterday. Those, they're not just courtroom dramas, but they're whodunit things. They are And you watch it unravel. You watch it all begin to evolve. And when they're well constructed films, they, so in this, because Crawford is always on top of the, with the funny remarks, always knocking them off balance, Ryan decided in the very first scene we did together, the very first shooting scene, was the scene in the interrogation room. And he decided not to be phased by Crawford, but to duck and weave around it, which made it much more interesting for me, and I think for the scene, because if it had been a young guy who's completely lost all the time, because every time he asked a question, this guy would zap him, then after about 2 minutes, the audience, yeah, but we got the joke now, so is this guy just so stupid that he... So, but Ryan played it very cleverly, because you, already you have the formula of this man who's... has a terrible broken down car, has a terrible life, lives in a crummy apartment, mm-hmm. and is always late and looks terrible and he's always a mess in this, you know. And which is actually Columbo. It's, and you think, yeah. And it's the same formula. So what he did was to play it like Peter Falk did, you know. Mm-hmm. Never be put off. Because I think that's a wonderful ingredient when you see Peter Falk trying to figure it out, and he looks like he doesn't know what time of day it is, and you see the killer, he says, this guy's an idiot, and this detective's a fool. But you know that Falk is 10 moves ahead, just putting all the... And that's what makes great whodunit films, and I think this is what Ryan chose to do. But sometimes with actors, when younger actors, if they sense that they're a little intimidated, and know where they would be, usually the first day, we'll do a scene together, and I'd say... And they say, okay, action, and cut. I say, oh, is that the way you're going to do it? I say, what? No, no, it's okay. I just wanted to... I say, director, is that the way he's going to play? I say, is something right? No, it's your career, you know. and then they get it, they say.
I got to ask you about the bark. It said that to just light up the set, you bark... Did you?
I thought, yeah,
you
just
when things... They won't know who did it?
Yeah, it barked like a dog. Because you know how sound people... I said, the dog on the set. I used to, on the Elephant Man, I was there, because they were so intense on that set, I should do a cat.
Oh, this is to line everything up. That's great.
And I'd do a clicking sound. You know, quiet, please. Stand by. Quiet. 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 Can you... Quiet, everyone. The clock to me. You can't see. Oh, I go, meow. Right. And they go, there's a cat here, so I'm not. And they, oh, you know, it can. Can someone close, check the doors, please? And actually,
you just have way too much fun.
Yeah. Actually, you know, when people get intense, it's, you know. There's a wonderful story about John Barrymore, and he was on stage, I think it was with Herbert Marshall, and he was a great prankster, and I think it was John Barrymore and Herbert Marshall. You remember Herbert Marshall?
He
was,
yeah.
And they were both wild boys, and I think it was Herbert Marshall, anyway. And John Barrymore went to the stage manager one night, and he said, on the scene when Herbert is sitting there, just ring the phone in the middle of the scene. He said, just ring the phone. And he's sitting there, he's going to have to. So he said, okay. So in the middle of the scene, the phone rings, and Herbert Marshall says, yes, it's for you.
So, Quinn, I was going to ask you, how do you know exactly how high to turn up the heat? Because for a role like this, I mean, you could really kind of chew up every piece of scenery on this, but it seems like you just kind of like, you know, kind of take it right down the middle there, and it's like sort of our expectation of what your character's going to do that kind of makes people like jump or squirm or whatever.
Yeah.
So how is that aspect of it? Because I'm sure, you know, you've done this kind of villainous thing before,
yeah.
but turning up the heat to that certain level, how do you know when you've reached it?
Oh, just an instinct. I remember we were doing a scene, we did a reshoot on this, the last scene, we reshot that from last year. And, my instinct, my actor's intelligence, I guess, tells me that I don't need to push it at all. I wanted to find the voice for the man, and when I was reading the script, you know, the maybe an odd line that becomes a favorite line, when he says in the interrogation room, he says, I say something to him, and he says, I'm not going to play games with you, and I say, I'm afraid you have to go sport. And it's like, that's it. And for some reason, it sounded Irish. I'm afraid you'll have to go sport. And then it connected to somebody I knew in England who was Irish and was a really ruthless, scary human being. He's, I don't know where he is now, but he was a great manipulator. He was a con man. He was a real con artist. And he'd say, where do you live? And he'd stare at you, and you know, he scared a lot of people. I don't know his name, but and I thought, that's this character. He's a tough, ruthless, he has no pity on anyone, but he has a sense of, I think he's a little strange, because he's, I don't want to classify him as a psychopath, but anyone who takes a pot shot and kills somebody must be a little bit disturbed, because what he could have done with his wife is just divorced her. She's having it. But he probably drove her to the lover anyway, because she says at the beginning, she said, I'm too tired for these games, before he kills her. So he's obviously a very cruel man and a control man, and like marriages or relationships where somebody is abusing somebody mentally, physically. I think that's what he does. I don't know if he's a physical abuser, but he's certainly a mental abuser. And I think he kills as a kind of existentialist exercise. There's a book by Colin Wilson called The Outsider, which is a great book on the alienation of people who, throughout history and in literature, who are the outsiders, like Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment, who are so divorced from them. They destroy things to see if they can free themselves from their own self-contempt. And I think Crawford's probably one of those guys. I
haven't heard that book mentioned for a long time.
That's kind of, that's a great book, isn't it?
He's sad, too, though, because he sees flaws in everything. How can he have a relationship with another human being when he sees everybody's flaw?
Well, he's happy to be on his own in his own demented way.
You say this is, in the notes, that this is only the second villain role that you've done.
Yeah.
What about Pravda?
Magic.
Well, Pravda? Well, no. Magic was just a little bit weird. He was a psychopath. Pravda, well, no, Pravda, he wasn't a villain. He was just a tycoon. You saw Pravda?
Oh, yeah.
He was just a business tycoon who was... He was
almost as scary as Hannibal Lecter.
with Pravda, with Lambert LaRue, he knew that everyone was buyable. Everyone had a price. Because he said, when the young journalist that finally meets him after the year, he said, I don't want to talk to you. He said, everyone says that, but they all do. Because he knew what power was. It doesn't make him evil, but it's ruthless.
Yeah. I was curious, just to break into another subject, but what other projects do you have coming up that you can talk about?
I was supposed to be, maybe a film about Hitchcock. It's a really good script, but it was postponed because we got to check with the Hitchcock estate. And it's not so much, it's about the making of Psycho, but it's not just about the making of Psycho, it's about the inner workings of Hitchcock's mind and his personality and his relationship with people.
Did it have was it set up at which studio? Did it have a director?
Yes, it had Ryan, the director of Running with the Scissors, Ryan Murphy. But I don't know what's happened, it's been postponed. And I've got another one on the table with Morgan Freeman and William Macy sometime this year. And another one, Wolfman, with Nicio Del Toro's in London, I think. But I haven't heard any more. My agent said it's a really good, fine script. And, so there are all kinds of things.
Haven't you just directed?
Yeah, I directed a film called Slipstream, which I wrote and played in. I wrote the music for it and all that. And I got a good cast. John Turturro, Christian Slater, Fionnuala Flanagan.
What's the status? What's the status of that?
I don't know. September, I think, beginning of release.
Did you enjoy your Sundance experience?
Yeah, I did.
Well, how many times have you been there?
I've only been there once for the actual festival, but I went there just on a brief few days holiday with my wife about 4 years ago. We traveled around the country. But that's the only time I've been to the festival.
did a little bit of you want this guy to get away and get knocked? when you're reading the script, do you want this guy just to get away, just leave?
What, this Crawford?
Yeah,
well, Crawford, did you want him to get away with it?
Part of me wants, yeah. Like, just, you know, I mean, I
it's like they want an elector to get away with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you're charming when you're evil.
I think what it is, in here, the classic villains are Iago and Richard III. I think they're attractive and charismatic because they walk the knife edge. They are, you know, the existentialist man. They dare everything. They have no, like the Scottish king, Shakespeare's Macbeth. They face catastrophe and they unblinkingly go on. And I think they're mesmeric because there's a part of our nature which would yearn to be that courageous. I think there are people like that in life. I had an uncle who was like that, my uncle Eric, and he was an amazing guy. He had no concerns about anything. I mean, he just breezed through life. He never paid his income tax. Sometimes he was broke, sometimes he'd make money. He wasn't a con man, but he was so charming. He didn't give a damn about anything. And I always remember, he's my hero. And I said to my remember saying to my aunt Gussie, which is his sister, and she was an elderly lady, and she was a very Christian and church-going, and I said, oh no, that's about another brother, my grandfather's brother, my Uncle Jim, who was a real, not a villain, but he was bad. He took money from people and borrowed money and never paid it back, and he died a lonely, miserable life at the end. But there's a photograph I had of him, and he was dressed in a kilt. I don't know, he wasn't even Scots, but he was a Scot, and he had his hat. He looked like a real villain, you know. I said to my Aunt Gussie, I said, what was Uncle Jim like? She said, oh, he was bad, terrible man. She said, but he was a laugh, though. She told me he'd have liked your Uncle Jim. She said, oh, he was a wicked man.
Well, see, I want him to get away so he could keep that car.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to ask if you think these family members could have been good actors.
Yeah, well, I guess they were.
You put your skills to good use.
Yeah, my father was a frustrated actor. He was a great storyteller. But my Uncle Jim, I never met him. He died in 1936. So, but I always used to ask my grandfather, how did you ever... He said, why, you're really interested in your Uncle Jim? I said, yeah, he was bad. But they all liked him. He's a scoundrel.
Mm-hmm. Was there a film, maybe when you were growing up, that kind of you feel changed your life or changed the way you thought about life or maybe wanted for you to get into this business?
I saw a movie when I was a little kid. It wasn't that little, but I was about 11 or 12 years of age. And it was a kind of sentimental old movie with Charlie Chaplin. It was called Limelight.
Yeah.
And I my parents took me to see it, and I was about 11 years of age. I was 12 years of age.
Mm.
And when I was in school, I was so hopeless at school. I didn't know what time of day it was. I couldn't figure anything out. I couldn't play sports. I couldn't understand what anyone was talking about. So I was the only child, and my father used to worry about me because I was terrible at my school reports. Mm. I felt pretty lonely, but I could play the piano and I could paint and I could write. I could write. So I was creative. So I went to see this film called Limelight, and it was about this failed man, this vaudeville guy, and he rescues this young girl from suicide, and he dies at the end while she goes on to success. And it touched me so deeply and profoundly that it started to change my life. And I wrote a letter to Chaplin. He was living in Switzerland. He'd just been kicked out of America. And he was living in Switzerland. So I wrote him a letter, and I got a letter back from him saying, thank you for your very nice letter. And 40-odd years later, it's extraordinary, I was sitting in the very house in Bevin doing a film with Robert Downey about Chaplin.
Oh.
And actually, in the garden of the house, I was, we were doing a film with Robert Downey, Richard Attenborough. And I was in the trailer, the dressing room, in Charlie Chaplin's garden that afternoon, having lunch, just lunch and the break. And there's knocking on the door, and Richard Attenborough directing him, and he said, I just want to see you've just been nominated for an Oscar for Silence of the Lambs. If somebody told me 40 years to the month that would have happened, I thought, I'm geeking. But it's so odd, and I think some of them be convinced that life is an illusion. It's all some kind of dream, that a fabric that we weave for ourselves. Mm-hmm. But that's metaphysics.
We have time for one more?
Aside from the Hitchcock characters, there's some other, character from history or whatever films that you would like to play at some point?
No.
Okay.
No, I've done it.
I'm going to do a last follow-up, but your character for the role that you're doing with William H. Macy and...
Do you know, I don't know about it yet. It's about three guys living working in an art gallery, and they become obsessed with these three pieces of independently in the same gallery. And the gallery's going to be sold, so they steal the pieces to save them. So it's kind of a nice comedy.
So it's a black comedy.
You never asked the question. Can you speak at all?
Thank you, everyone.
Did you ever speak?
No.
She's pretty rich.
Does that film have a title?
I can't remember the title.